You don't rise to the occasion. You fall to the level of your training. And at that moment, we realized we fell a long way when we were under stress. I could have never done the things we did years later in combat had we not gone through those trials then and found out in a safe environment, here's how to fail, here's how to improve upon that failure, and here's how to constantly get better.
When you think of a great leader, who comes to mind? And what is it that you really admire about that person? What is it that you wish you could distill down and ingest so that you could be more that way? This next guest is someone that is that for me. He's that way for me. He is such a good leader, and he's such a good father, and he's such a good friend, and a great storyteller, and like all these things. Just someone who really gives permission and inspires others. And so in this conversation, we talked about trying to distill that down. Pretty amazing. This is someone who was a Navy SEAL, someone who's got 5 kids, someone who's involved in so many different organizations. So if you're really curious to hear some of the distilled messages of what great leadership looks like, I hope this is an invitation for you to level up your leadership as well.
Welcome to The Dream Beyond. I'm your host, Nick Tarascio. I'm a CEO, musician, and overall seeker of truth, inspiration, and simply put, how to live the most fulfilling life possible. Growing up surrounded by extremely wealthy and successful people gave me unique and unfiltered perspectives of those who have seemingly made it. And on The Dream Beyond, we're letting you in on what it really takes to achieve your dreams, what happens when it turns out your destination isn't the promised land you were expecting, and how to process the lessons from your past while mapping a course to true fulfillment. Let's get started.
Hey everybody, I'm here with a former Navy SEAL who's got a 20-year career where he served in 18 countries, undertook over 13 deployments, playing a pivotal role in uniting agencies at all levels of the government and foreign partners to achieve monumental objectives. He's the co-founder and managing partner of the Broadway Strategic Return Fund, which focuses on the performing arts industry. He's also a co-founder and COO of TBD Studios, aimed at bringing Broadway to global audiences. And most importantly, he's a dedicated husband and father of 5, lifelong student of transformation, applying his profound experience and insights from the SEALs to inspire, heal, and connect humanity, aiming for a scalable, open source, and anti-fragile future. Please welcome my dear friend, Kurt Cronin, everybody. Thanks for being here, Kurt.
Thanks, Nick. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So we're going to dive right in with, just starting way back. When you were little, what did you dream you'd be when you grew up?
My dad was a veterinarian, and so he always talked about his vision for me to become a doctor. So I think my earliest visions were aligned to the vision that my father had.
And did you start down that path at all?
To some extent. The most fascinating twist was my family used to take vacations to national parks, and we had a van with 2 car top carriers. And so one was loaded with luggage, one was loaded with tents and equipment. And so we'd camp all around the United States at all the national parks. And when I think I was about 16, we drove through the gates of the Naval Academy. And the Marine gate guard made a mistake that changed all the plans. He thought my dad looked like the superintendent, so he popped a salute to him. And my dad said, "You're going." And I was like asleep in the back, and I was 10-to-1 guy to girl ratio. I was kind of into girls right then, and I didn't really like the idea of marching around and doing drill. And so I had no desire to apply to the Naval Academy. And my dad said, "Unconditional love, you can always come home, but you're going to try this." And so put the application process in, and then got accepted. And so that fateful salute from that Marine fundamentally changed the course of my career.
What was like? Was that the only inspiration, or did your dad have inklings of like you should go to the Navy?
No, I think our family had always been centered around service, and for him, he was an unbelievable leader, guide, and mentor. And I believe he found that to be the most aspirational out of his range of expected outcomes for his own life that he could imagine. I was from what I would call a tiny farm town of 4,000 people. He was from a tiny farm town of about 16 in rural Kansas. And so I believe that was his perspective on that was the most extraordinary, unbelievable thing he could ever imagine. And that's why I think he imagined it and desired that for me. And it's one of the, I would not be half the man I am today had I not followed his guidance and perspective. Now, I did not want to go, but I also was completely aware that it was his utmost desire for me, and he'd never steered me wrong. And so that leap of faith to trust his intuition, his perspective, was incredibly powerful. And it's the constant balance I try and strike every single day with my children, as now my oldest is 15, my youngest is 3. How do I each day impart wisdom, impart mandatory fun for them, new experiences that they may not want to do, so that they'll have greater context? Because I think it's hard to make a decision based on zero context. And so how do I set the environment where they get to have the broadest set of context possible so they can make the best decisions in the future?
Wow. So this is going to go in a different direction than I thought it was today, because one of the things I admire most about you is how you show up as a father. And again, you have a lot of things to admire. There's so many things you do that I deeply admire. I want to get a little bit more background, and then I want to go there and talk about it again. Like, I have a kid on the way, and I just think, like, there are a few men in my life that I look up to, and I'm like, how do you do that? So first tell us, so you end up in the Navy. How did this happen? How did you end up in the SEALs specifically? Like, what was the path for you?
Once I accepted the appointment to the Naval Academy, I got to the Naval Academy, and the first semester did not go well. So I was used to things moving about the speed that crops grew. And so you can imagine a world where suddenly people are yelling and screaming about shoe shine, the name tags, and things that were not relevant to the world I came from. And so it was a significant disconnect between the world I came from and the world I'd now entered. And so it took me 6 months to adapt. And in fact, I actually came home at Thanksgiving from my plebe year at the Naval Academy, and I read James Webb's A Sense of Honor. And I remember reading that book and thinking, wow, that plebe is doing some really absurd and stupid things. And then I realized that plebe was me. And so it was a complete unlock for me. I simply couldn't see the mirror until it was reflected to me in a story that then changed everything. I literally went from, I can't possibly learn all of these rates and all of the things that are demanding of me, into, no one studied or worked as hard as I can, so of course I'm going to go out and know more than the upper class. And so it was a complete shift. And the only shift, real shift, was the shift in confidence and the shift in desire, the shift in belief, where before the energy that I exuded was one of, please ask me a question I don't know, I'm going to screw it up, right? Which led to that outcome every single time. And I manifested that outcome. And then the next shifted to, I'm completely committed to the cause, and ask me anything you want, and I will have studied, worked, and prepared, and I'll be ready for it. And so that was the first quantum shift. And then I had decided, well, if I was going to be at this school, I should at least jump out of airplanes. And so my youngster summer, the first summer is plebe summer, my youngster summer, I went to jump school, and I was completely terrified of Sergeant Airborne. They were the cadre that were running the course. And there are these guys in the back of the class that the instructors got tired of yelling at them before they got tired of doing push-ups. And so I was completely astounded that someone would have this kind of courage, charisma, confidence. And turned out they were Navy SEALs that had just gone through BUDS training. And this was the post-BUDS airborne qualification before they got assigned to a SEAL platoon. And so following, you know, the intuition of leaders who set the example for me, i.e. my father, was one aspect of my upbringing. The other was, run at that which you fear the most. And so the most terrifying thing I could ever imagine was trying to lead these charismatic warriors in combat. And so that started my quest to become a Navy SEAL. Now, to go back to your first question, I had a choice. I thought life was to defend and to heal. So I had a choice my first class year, whether I was going to go into the medical corps, I'd gotten accepted into Dartmouth Medical School, or into the SEALs. And it was one of those harrowing decisions. I remember I spent most of my first class year deciding which path I was going to take. And it came down to the day of the decision. It was supposed to be by 1 p.m. The way that service assignment works is, if you take your name out of the hat for active duty, i.e. if I pulled my name out for medical corps, then I'd go medical corps. If I left my hat in the ring for active duty, I might go SEALs, or I might get picked for whatever else the needs of the Navy were. And so I walked around Luce Hall, which was our leadership and training facility for, you probably still have like a 2 or 3 inch indentation from all the laps I walked around Luce Hall in that period getting ready for it. And I finally walked in at 12:55, and there was a Marine captain, so an O3, sitting there at the in his desk. He said, "What do you need, midshipman?" I said, "Sir, when do you need the decision for whether names are in the hat for service assignment or out?" And he's like, "I'm going over at 1:10. And he could sense my angst. And I said, I'll be back. And he said, nope, I need your decision right now. What's your question? And so I'd never met this gentleman before, never saw him ever again. But I asked him, have you ever served in combat? And he said, yes, I have. I said, what did you think? He said, it's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And so I just turned and walked away, because if I left my hat, my name in the selection, then that left me in the selection process for the SEALs, and that started that whole path. And so, you know, it's that fascinating series of decisions to decide to cut off all other options that led me down a road that, looking back, it totally makes sense. But if I'm every moment looking forward, every decision seems like it's, you know, completely chaotic and completely unexpected.
Wow. It's amazing. It like comes down to minutes, sometimes seconds, right? Like a major shift in life. What I'd love to take a shift on with that is, so you have obviously a beautiful perspective, both as a son of someone who you identify as a great leader and as a great leader who's a father. And I'm wondering, what was it that your dad did right? What's the stuff where you're like, I wanted to bottle that and I wanted to bring that to the way I raise my own children?
That's a great question. I think the number one thing he did, that now that you bring it to my conscious forefront and the thing I hope to bring to my children, is I knew every single action he took was in my best interest. Whether or not I liked it or whether or not I did not like it, I knew that he was acting, and whether or not he was right or wrong, I knew that his intent was to help make my life better than his, right? To help give me lessons, perspective, content, context that I never could have expected. And my wife and I tell my children all the time, our whole mission is to make your life better than ours. That's our quest. And so you may or may not like what we're telling you. And in the end, you're going to get to decide how you live your life. And we want you to decide that, because that is, in the end, we're just trying to build a platform for you. But there's so much that has gone right across the history of your descendants for them to mate and for you to be here. Please allow us to help you start at least in the 2010s, not back, you know, thousands of years BC. And so that's the quest, is how do I give them context, experiences, and the ability to, hopefully, the courage to both lean into their intuition and trust their intuition in order to make decisions for situations that we could never fathom. It's one of my favorite things at night when I put the kids to bed, is to imagine what kind of worlds are they going to see. Things are evolving so fast. What's their world going to look like? What are the things that they're going to see in their lifetime that are so far beyond anything I could ever fathom?
It's a beautiful mission, and it's a beautiful perspective. And how did your dad communicate that to you? Like, how did you receive that message?
Every way. I think most seriously in his earnestness and in his desire to serve. I remember the reason he was a veterinarian was that he could not speak to the people across the table from him. He was incredibly shy. And so he left pharmacy school, where he and my mom had met, and went to become a veterinarian, because the assumption was then he wouldn't have to talk to people. And of course, as a veterinarian, you now have to intuitively understand the animal, but most importantly, the anxious owner that's upset, you know, about the animal. And so I remember when I was very young, he was doing Toastmasters and doing Dale Carnegie, and every single time he was learning something, his constant commitment to growth, he would also most times unwittingly pull me into the process and pull, you know, my brother and sister into the process of, here's what I'm learning, so here's what I want you to learn. And so he imparted that growth mindset, that growth perspective, and that constant and never ending improvement.
So you have a brother and a sister. I'm wondering, did they receive that same message, or was this uniquely the way that you and your dad related that message came through?
You'd have to ask them directly to make sure you get the correct answer, but I would say my brother and I probably received it very similarly. I think it was different for my sister, just because of the difference between a father-daughter and father-son. But I think the same aura of servant leadership, growth, and the desire for both of our parents to constantly do what was the best for us and help us to grow. And now that you know, I get deeper into it, constantly keep us uncomfortable in making sure we're in situations that are difficult. And I remember they wouldn't make decisions for me. I remember at the Naval Academy calling almost every night for 2 months trying to decide for what, for me, felt like a life-changing decision between mechanical engineering, where I'd started, and chemistry, which is what I felt called to go into. And I remember them listening and listening and listening, but never making the decision. And so, you know, that was that kind of fascinating transition for, he made the decision for me to go to the Naval Academy, but beyond that, continued to pull back from and give me more and more context to make my own decisions, while all the time providing a sound platform. And I remember telling a friend, and I didn't understand this, because when I got to the Naval Academy, mom and dad for me was a single noun. I didn't realize that they were really two separate people. I considered them an entity all the way through like my junior or senior year at the Naval Academy. And so it wasn't until I saw the contrast of many of my classmates in the Naval Academy that I understood that was an uncommon experience, that I've been very blessed to have seen one of the most, I'd say, wholesome and powerful dyadic relationships that existed. And that model has been a huge source of energy for me. Dad was always very similar to what you'll see in parenting. Dad was always the visionary that was casting out and moving forward. And my mom was always setting the foundation where wherever we fell, we were going to have a soft landing. And so the combination of those two and that unconditional love allowed us to try crazy things that, if failure meant death, would have been unattainable. But if failure meant soft landing and build again, then we were free to fly.
Beautiful. So again, you're such an interesting example of someone who came from this just amazing, loving container. It sounds like it's what a healthy family dynamic sounds like. And then you get dropped into some of the highest performing leadership training and development I could ever imagine. And what lessons did you take from the SEALs to apply to the way you show up as a father?
Well, I would take it one step back. I think the best thing I ever did as a leader in the SEALs was apply that servant leadership and unconditional love to my men. And that was the framework I came from. So that was the only frame that I had. My favorite nickname on the planet that the SEALs have is Team Guy. And I love that the Navy SEALs are not great by design. It's actually default. Because if you think about the Navy, in the 1700s, if a Navy ship went to sea, you are not going to talk to your boss again for the next 7 months. And so the Navy, because of the lack of technology, used to have command by negation. So you knew you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. Everything else, you're going to have to figure it out. And so you had command by negation, and the necessary difficulties of working in the water required swim buddies, required having teammates. And so enter the information age, and we were used to decentralized environments and working in teams. And so that we ended up having the conditions set perfectly for us to be able to function as high-performing teams.
Going back to unconditional love, I imagine that for most people that know very little about the SEALs, that's not what they would expect, right? If they were like, hey, what did good leadership look like in the SEALs? Unconditional love. I don't think that's where most people's minds would go, right? It's more like tactically sharp, super well executed, right? People that are really coordinated. How does that unconditional love show up in leadership in a hard environment like that?
Well, I think it is the unlock that allowed SEALs to do superhuman things with very average humans. Because if you really look at it as Greek philia, right? It's that brotherly love. It's whether you looked at the Spartans, where the shield that was held by one person was the thing that protected, you know, their counterpart. And that's why the phalanx was so powerful. And so to me, the SEALs were that modern day phalanx, where the fact that each person knew that no one was coming home without their teammate was what allowed each person to be in full commitment, full surrender, full flow with each other. And that's what allowed that seemingly impossible dynamic subordination. And it extended to the team. The helicopter pilots would be completely in charge. If something went wrong on the insert and the helicopter pilot said, hey, this isn't a go, we turn around, because they were completely in charge up until the moment we landed. And then the reconnaissance element, the point guys that were the most qualified to get us there, would then take charge and lead us to within about 100 meters of the target. And then the breachers would go up front. They were the most qualified to open the door. And then as soon as the door was open, then the assaulters would go in. And so it was that dance of each person knew when it was theirs to do, they would take over and take the responsibility of carrying the weight of the team. And the moment it was not theirs, do you hand it over to somebody else? And so that interdependence is the thing that made all the difference. And so I think whether it's in a family unit, whether it's in a professional context like the SEALs or in a business, when people say culture, you know, each strategy for breakfast, for me, what they really mean is the critical interpersonal relationships that have no boundaries, that no one in that team will quit on each other, is the thing that is the unparalleled unlock that most seek in life and in the world.
Wow. It's like absolutely perfect timing as I'm working through my thoughts around heart forward leadership, right? Heart centered leadership. It's something that I found it really hard to do. This is my own bias, and I don't know if anyone else relates to this, but when I hear love or heart or any of these things in leadership, especially in high performing, it sounds soft, right? It actually sounds like, oh, that's someone I would have a hard time trusting because they're going to be like very, very soft in their approach and they're not going to hold people accountable. I guess I'm curious to know more about how do you bring love and high performance and accountability in there and like be hard on the process, or is it being hard on the person? Like, how do you manage that?
Well, you might be right. I might have used the incorrect word, or at least my definition might be different. Unconditional love might be more like cosmic love, right? And so if I'm fully committed to the team, then that means I am now morally obligated to tell you if you're doing something wrong. So there's no people pleaser, which is my background is like, you know, I'm a recovering people pleaser. If something goes wrong, the after action review, right after we got off a target, we would have some of the most, you can call it a difficult conversations, but instantaneous hard conversations of, you were supposed to do this, that didn't happen. We have to debrief that right now as a collective because someone might die 5 minutes from now and we go back out the door if we don't correct this right now. So it is both that paradox of the softness of being held and the crucial hardness of being held accountable, right? If in the SEALs, we would say, it's totally okay if you've got it. It's totally okay if you tell everyone you don't have it. The unforgivable was to say you have it and not have it, right? To have an injury and say, hey, I'm good to be able to do whatever my task is, but then not be able to carry it out. To not be completely forthright, honest, transparent, and clear was unforgivable because no one can cover what they don't know to cover. If they know we're vulnerable on the left flank, we can cover it. If we know we're vulnerable on the right flank, we can cover it. If we think the left is covered and therefore I'm not looking there and now we're uncovered, that was the piece that was the unforgivable component. And so you're absolutely right that it can appear soft, but it's also actually both sides of the paradox means I can't not tell you the thing that went wrong. I can't not say whatever hard truth needs to be said. It is my obligation to tell you that because I'm abandoning my job as a teammate if I'm leaving the team vulnerable in any way that I can see. And so since each person has a different perspective, that means constant feed forward, not really feedback, because we're not worried about the past. It's how are we impacting the future? So it's constantly working with each person to continue to evolve, to allow each person to move out of any of their flaws and weaknesses and to compensate with that with generated strength.
That's really cool that the parallel of that, you know, the paradox of the soft and also the like that hard edge, it sounds like in a lot of ways it was your dad and your mom. And it's like she was that soft, we got you. And he was the like, you're going to do the uncomfortable thing. It's in service of you.
Yeah, I had not thought about that.
It's pretty cool to kind of hear that connection. That's pretty awesome. Can you tell me about a time where, like, I'm wondering, were there times where someone did screw it up, where you said like the one unforgivable thing is saying you got it when you don't got it? Did that happen? Were there moments where, because especially if it's unforgivable, like I'm curious how that plays out with someone if they did step out of that.
Well, mistakes were made all the time. And when people say no fail mission in the SEALs, we don't actually mean we never failed. What we mean is we never quit. And so one of my superpowers, I fail at things faster than anyone else I know. And so for me, failure is another learning iteration. And so if I can learn 10 different reps per day, quote, failures, then in the end, I get to learn the fastest, which will lead to the ultimate outcome. Think the Thomas Edison, you know, if it's not yet instead of no, that allows me to get to those 10,000 trials. And so we were always learning. I think that was the best thing we learned in the SEALs was always to learning how to learn, right? How do we get to the person that is the best in the world? And how do we completely surrender to be able to learn from them so we can learn at the fastest possible level? And then the moment they're gone, now take leadership. Because if you couldn't learn from them, you could never learn, you could never evolve fast enough to survive in combat. If you didn't take command, once they were gone, then there was no one to lead. And so the ability to kind of cycle between those two was a critical aspect. If there was an integrity violation, fundamentally what you're talking about is if there was a moment where someone said they had it and they didn't, or someone said they were going to do something and they didn't, then that was a breach of trust. And if there's a breach of trust, then they might have got sent home from deployment. You know, there would have been some repercussions/rehabilitation depending on how serious the offense was. So learning was and making mistakes happened continuously. And that was completely forgivable. The goal was we want you to continue to make new mistakes. Ideally, we don't make the same mistake twice because that puts us at risk. That means we're not learning, we're not evolving, we're not getting better.
Man, there's a lot coming up for me. And I'll tell you, it's like I never know where this thing's going to go, but this past week I've had to apologize to my team quite a bit, my executive team, because I'm noticing that somehow, some way, I had this programming that said I'm supposed to protect them from discomfort, right? Like it's like the very unevolved leadership style. Hey, I don't want to like be too hard on you. I see you're trying hard. I see you're trying to do the right thing. And so I kind of let it go. But then all I did was just formed resentment. And it starts a lot of like the blame game stuff, or like I kind of secretly give up on somebody before I even gave them a chance or told them what I really need from them. So I'm hearing a lot of like my nice guy approach and people pleaser approach has actually prevented me from being the kind of leader that you're talking about. And it's obviously even raises the stakes. I'm like, yeah, business is business. But I wonder as a father, I'm like, I don't want to do that there too. Like I actually really want to solve that and heal that relationship. So as a dad, I don't show up in the way of like, oh yeah, let's be soft on the kid. Let's not push him too hard. But in reality, like I've kind of lost faith in a child or something like that. So I'm wondering, like, because you said you are a recovering or a recovered people pleaser.
Recovering.
How did you do that? Okay, fair enough.
I mean, for me, it comes down to the realization that if I'm trying to be a people pleaser, it means because I don't care enough to tell them the truth. Right? I don't like uncomfortable conversations. And so I have to future pace it. If I don't help this person have this conversation right now, then over the next 30 years, if no one has that conversation with them, they won't get to be CEO, CMO, CTO, you know, whatever it is they want to become. If I can't have the courage to tell them about a flat spot and they never evolve, then that's my fault. And so for me, true love for someone is I'm going to express in the most compassionate terms I possibly can the truth that I see so that they have the opportunity, and that's up to them whether they take that opportunity or not, they have the opportunity to grow and evolve. And so that's how I have to future pace. What's the implication if I continue this action, if I continue not speaking truth, if I continue people pleasing, if I continue being nice, then I'm actually failing them. I'm failing to allow them to grow to their ultimate destiny because of my lack of courage. And that's the part that completely reverses my people pleaser. If I truly care about them, I have to tell you now what's happening that's not going to serve you in the future. And to go back to your point, I think one of the greatest untruths of our time is that life is supposed to be happiness. I think true warriors seek joy and pain. And not necessarily seek the pain, but know that the experience of that pain is telling me something I'm doing is not correct. Pain is increasing my awareness and telling me, oh, there's an action. I need to speak something with my wife or with my partner or with whomever it is that I feel that pain or that discomfort in my relationship. That discomfort is telling me I'm not where I could be or should be. And there's a gap between my ideal world and my current world. And so when I cover that gap, then I get the joy of, aha, back to alignment. And that's where my mentor, Tom Crum, will always talk about how you're not, and I think it's the Bruce Lee quote, you're not fighting from center, you're fighting to get back to center. Because I thought, well, if I'm supposed to be centered all the time, then I was in the perfection mindset, always wrong. But if I'm always realizing, oh, I'm off center right now, how do I get closer to center? How do I get closer to my ideal? Then that creates the opportunity for continuous improvement.
Man, that's some sobering information. I'm just sitting here like, wow, I like to think I'm a good leader, but this is definitely a weak spot, right? Like the idea of a reframe of, because I'm thinking like, why don't I do it, right? Like, why don't I sit down with someone? And it's like, oh, I'm being compassionate, but it is true. It's that I don't care enough. I don't care enough to put myself, it's actually about me protecting me from being in an uncomfortable situation.
Yes.
I don't really want to deal with that. That sucks. That sucks to sit with that reality.
It sucks and You're now awake. you're now aware. Before, you had no ability to change. And so the only thing I'll recant from before is you said, my dad will absolutely say he's a great leader. I hope someday to become, right? It's the process of becoming. The moment I become my own hero and say I'm a great leader, then I'll stop growing. But ideally, I'm in the quest to become, and I have awareness of mistakes that I've made and mistakes I have been making because I thought of myself as a good leader, which meant I thought I'm good enough. And then now I have whole new levels of, wow, so much growth to be done. So many unfoldings, so much awareness of where I can be better and more empathetic and where I have unintentionally harmed someone through either what I've said or what I have not said, that it reignites the entire quest. And so I love your word of sobering. It's like, oh, wow, if I really get awake and aware, if you and I can drop into a field together and collectively create an awareness of, wow, here's where true center is. Here's how we can both get better. And that's the most epic part of any conversation. If we get into a relationship where we both exit better than we started.
Yeah, that's a win. So I love this frame of like, it's all about returning to center. And so like my immediate reaction is like, yeah, I want to go and do all these things. I have this aspiration of, I want to bring that unconditional love or that cosmic love and that care. And it's like, hey, you're on my team. I'm committed to you, whatever it takes. How do I not go the other way and end up going, I gave myself away to the team, right? I was so in servant leadership, or maybe I don't even understand exactly what servant leadership is, that I would even think, what if I run myself out of energy? What if I lose the balance in my personal life because I've given myself away to the team, or I've given myself away to someone else that I'm trying to serve? How do you find that healthy balance there?
Well, if you fail, epic. That didn't work. Now there's a million and one other things I can try that might work. Right? The worst for me is status quo. If status quo is no change, at least if I try something and it's worse, well, now I have an awareness that that's not the thing. And usually I can now go, okay, what about that didn't work? If I can analyze it and learn from the past, I can now have a better future. So the more experiences I can log, the greater data set I have to be able to be better in the future. And so, of course, like anything that you're going to try, anything that's worth doing is worth doing poorly, right? Is worth being poor at the first time I try it, because I'll never forget the first time I was ever in command. We were at Bud's at the island where they say, no one can hear you scream. So we're in the middle of nowhere out in San Clemente Island and all with blanks, but the instructors, initiated an attack, and my team, we ended up in a formation never to be repeated again, but known as the Starburst. So if we're in line, we're supposed to be able to react in order, like directing our energy towards wherever the attack is coming from. And the entire team, instead of that, just starburst in every direction, complete pandemonium, complete chaos, total lack of command and control, total lack of any command presence. And I got back that night, and a good friend had led another op, and we were both just in utter dismay because we'd completely failed. We'd had our moment, and it had gone as horribly as could possibly be imagined. And then at the bottom, eventually we just start laughing. Like, well, I guess it can get nowhere but better from here. And so that piece was crucial to know, wow, I have to better brief. I have to better prepare. My assumption was I had given guidance and people had heard it. And they may have intellectually heard it, but it was not embodied. We hadn't gone through the embodied training and exercises and all the different things to allow us. You don't rise to the occasion. You fall to the level of your training. And at that moment, we realized we fell a long way when we were under stress. And so it became, how do we now build a platform so we fall less far, so we're better when the next crisis hits? And I could have never done the things we did, years later in combat had we not gone through those trials then and found out in a safe environment, here's how to fail, here's how to improve upon that failure, and here's how to constantly get better.
Yeah, that's the permission. That's great to hear. It's like, I think even that, I could tell that there's a perfectionist layer in my question to you. It's like, how do I do it right? And I love that your answer is like, do it wrong. Just do it wrong until you realize how not to do it wrong anymore.
It's the only way I know.
That's brilliant. Because you're right. It is an embodiment thing. I think, it's like in my head, I actually know rationally the right thing to do so often. And when I find myself in the actual field, whatever that thing is, I still do the wrong thing, which tells me that you kind of hit it on the head. this is a training, this is embodiment, this is getting it into habit. I think it might have been Carol Dweck, but I'm not sure if that's who said it.
Her growth mindset is everything we're talking about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think before we run out of time, one of the things I want to touch on is one of the other things I admire about you is that you teach through story. Like even in this, you know, there's a lot of story. There's a lot of people that I think say like, you should do this and you should do that and you should do this. And yours is always like, here's an illustrative story. Let me take you through the journey. Let me help you see it through my eyes. I know that so much of your current life is around story. And so I'm curious to hear in your own words, how does story relate to what you feel about, you know, setting kids up for a better life, helping people learn and grow, bringing that cosmic love? How does story relate to that?
Well, story feels like the only path we actually learn. If I intellectually tell you something, then you have to decide, is that true or is it not true? There's an evaluative analytical process. Whereas if I can relate a story, and I loved the Shakespearean catharsis that I experienced with, I had this amazing professor at the Naval Academy, at the end of the story, like, wow, that doesn't feel good. I have some things to clean up in my life. And so that I love stories that are either cautionary tales that are, wow, this is not how I want to show up, or inspirational tales, that's how I seek to become. And then now I have a model for who I could become in the future, a model of possibility. And stories are fun because I think nonfiction, we get to tell the truth about events, and fiction, we get to tell the truth about the humans, because we don't have an emotional charge because it's a fictional character. Therefore, we allow our imaginations, we allow possibility to run wild. We don't get it constrained by that's impossible that anybody could be that disciplined or that this or that. And so the fictional stories allow us to have an aspirational character that we don't hold in judgment, that we don't hold any envy of. And instead we can say, wow, how do I become like that? And then it becomes a fun quest of how do I become more like that in my life on a daily basis.
So I'm going to throw this in there because I was really affected by our last conversation where you talked about Superman. And I'm wondering, like, when it comes to fictional characters, I imagine we all have things we aspire towards. We all look for models of it. And again, any human we know is a limited capacity, right? Because we don't know the full depths of them because they are a nonfiction character. What fictional character do you think to when you think that's leadership at its highest?
Well, you've already called out Superman. So, of course, I've always loved Superman for his ability to do the things that are impossible for others. And that's one of my quests in life, is how do I make the impossible the inevitable? And I say that with a small I, not a big I, because I love taking on huge missions that are infinitely larger than me, because I know there's only a tiny piece that I can do. And there's a massive gap that has to be filled by others, and prevents me from ever getting the illusion that the capital I is the thing that will do it. And so I love Superman, and I love, one of my favorite rituals at night is I will integrate in who are all of my heroes in the past, like Teddy Roosevelt. Fictional to me because I never got to meet him. Everything I read about him and his ability to kick off the national parks and build, you know, something that I love so that people can endure and see it forever, and his ability to be, you know, one of the Rough Riders and be courageous. Tony Robbins, his unbelievable charisma. My mentor, Sensei Tom Crum, and his ability to embody centered at a level that I've never seen. So I love to look at what is a superpower that each person has, and how do I integrate each of those superpowers into me in a way that I can ideally become the best possible version of myself. And so I love the quote of, you know, what, I've never met someone I didn't like. It's fun to ask, what's your superpower? It's my favorite question when I meet someone, what's their superpower? Because I feel like you don't get to use it until you can call it by name. And it's so exciting to realize that each person has. Someone the other day said, curiosity is a superpower. I love that. Someone said, like, I inspire hope. I'm like, ah, fantastic. I want to pull that in. So it's a fun integrative process of, like, every single human has some unique, the Thor's hammer, what's theirs to do. It's infinitely light. It's not theirs to do. It's infinitely heavy, which allows them to have complete access to a unique aspect of humanity. And then how do I now integrate the best of that into me if I aspire to, and know who to call if I need a capability that is beyond what I have?
Has your superpower changed over time?
I believe it constantly evolves. when I have different levels of awareness of where I feel a lack. And so for certain to start with, it began in the achiever mode of how do I get better as a runner in track, or how do I get better as a shooter in the SEALs, or how do I get better at individual skill sets, and how do I continue to build skill sets, which fundamentally was training in mastery. How do I learn how to learn? So that was the meta skill I really learned in that phase. And then it was, how do I shift from constantly running from scarcity and perfection into how do I get pulled by abundance? And that was a harrowing transition, because my fear was, if I'm no longer scared and I'm pulled by abundance, would I still be as motivated and as driven as I have been in the past? Massive shift when I shifted into pulled by abundance. And now it's, how do I more appreciate the brilliance and perfection being a scary word? How do I appreciate the beauty in every single moment? So how do I end the suffering that I've had when I created a judgment or a story that was not useful? And how do I reframe that as rapidly as possible? I'm pretty sure I'll never get to the point where I can instantly reframe it, but I'm definitely trying to get faster than the decades long it used to take me to get through and end the suffering that I created through creation of a negative story. And I love the Viktor Frankl quote, you know, the greatest of all freedoms is the freedom to choose. So we get to choose our story. Ideally, I continue to choose better stories that better allow me to help others and help others on their quest.
Beautiful. Last question for you before we land this thing. What's your dream beyond?
So when I left the SEALs, I was a part of an incredible organization that was helping to do, you know, impossible missions around the world. And when I left, my vision was to always create invisible squadron. Like, what is the squadron that no longer needs SEALs? What is the world that no longer needs combat? What is the world where we can learn proactively to find challenges and have them solutions ready before the crisis ever arises? And so that is my quest now, is how do I find the others? Because I do believe that small groups of people in full commitment to each other can drive exponential and asymmetric change. And so how do I find the others? How do I be supportive of the others? How do I help each person to unlock their superpower so that we as a collective for humanity can become infinitely better than we are now?
Oof, gorgeous. That's a beautiful vision of the future. Well, I'm inspired. Every time we talk, I'm like always just deeply, deeply inspired. You've given me a lot of permission in our conversations. And I don't know if you meant to do that or not, but just the way you share your stories, it's like all these things unlock in me. And I just want to share a couple of the biggest takeaways for me is I'm going to totally steal your mission that it's, you know, as a parent to give our kids a better life. I'm actually like, I can't wait to talk to OJ and be like, OJ, what do you think? Is this our mission? Can we put this mission statement up on the wall? This, you know, just this call to servant leadership and unconditional love or the cosmic love and really like bringing, again, for me, it's permission to bring more heart. But also, again, bringing the softness of heart with that hard edge of like, I do care enough to tell you what's missing or what didn't work or where you're getting stuck or where you're hitting a wall and really reframing that. And just again, I know for me, it actually is a courage problem. It's, do I have the courage to sit in that discomfort across from someone knowing that it may hurt for them in the moment? But can I communicate like your dad did the message so clearly that no matter what I say, always know it's in service of you because I just want you to be better. And I just want you to be successful. And then I don't know about, you know, anybody who's listening, but I'm like, wait, what is my superpower, right? Like that's pretty cool. And allowing the evolution of that and thinking of the people that inspire me with theirs. So thank you for that, man. This is such good stuff. Wow. Yeah. I'm pretty leveled by our conversations as always. Anything you want to share for the listeners, anything that you think might be helpful for someone if they're like, hey, I really want to lean in on being a better father, leader, manager, someone who is elevating people, someone who's trying to contribute. As you said, you're trying to find the others. How does someone become one of the others?
I think the most succinct is to the Nelson Mandela quote, be the change you wish to see in the world. For me, there's so many of us that have an awareness of where we could be. And then there's the, but I'm not perfect and here I am. So I don't know what change to make first. And so it really just becomes start doing the thing. Start doing whatever you're called to do, whatever small, insignificant change you can make. I'm continuously astounded by the compounding impact of sharing with people my fear, sharing my concerns, asking for help. I'm probably the worst asker for help. And every single time I have asked, I have been blown away by the support, the grace, and the miracles I've been shown. So, take the small step, make the ask, do the thing.
Beautiful. Well, thank you again for the time. I hope everyone enjoyed. Yeah, man, I look forward to our next conversation as always.
All in. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Dream Beyond. I hope that you received whatever message or inspiration you were meant to get from today's episode. I had a great time recording it for you. If you love the show, please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review it. That really helps get the word out. And if you want to connect with me, you can find me at instagram.com/NickTerasio, linkedin.com/in/NickTerasio, or youtube.com/NTerasio.